Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Transportation Finance and Policy Committee for this January 21st, 2021. My name is Frank Hornstein. I'm a representative from Minneapolis. I'm chairing the committee. And just a couple of quick housekeeping items before we get into the substance of our meeting. We're going to be taking the roll via Mr. Dan Dodge, our committee administrator. So members, when you hear your name, just simply say present. That's our first item of business. Mr. Dodge.
Chair Hornstein.
Present.
Vice Chair Cagle. Representative Petersburg.
Present.
Representative Barr.
Present.
Representative Bernardi.
Present.
Representative Elkins.
Present.
Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick.
Present.
Representative Hausman.
Present.
Representative Heinrich.
Present.
Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Murphy.
Present.
Representative Nelson.
Present.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Richardson. Present. Representative Torkelson. Representative Torkelson. Representative West. Representative West. Representative West, you are muted, but I can see you on the call. There is a quorum.
I believe Representative Kosnick is here too.
Kosnick present.
Cagle present.
Present.
Kosnick and Cagle are present. Thank you, members. We have a quorum, so we do have a quick item of business that we'll be voting on, and that's approval of the minutes January 19th. Representative Petersburg, is there a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I would like to move the adoption of the January 19th minutes.
Representative Petersburg moves the minutes. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? The motion carries. If there are any additional members that we missed during the roll call that have joined us, please state your name and present.
Representative Torkelson is here now.
Yeah, I was hoping maybe, well, we'll, Representative Torkelson, are you connected here yet?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I had a little trouble getting on.
Yeah. Representative Torkelson is present. Well, members, we have a packed agenda today, and I just wanted to very quickly set the stage for our business. We are continuing. This is the last in our series of introductory hearings about COVID and transportation. We have the leaders of different state entities, regional entities that we have some jurisdiction over in this committee. We've asked them to come to talk a little about how COVID has impacted them and maybe a little bit of projecting into the future how those impacts will affect their operations and their agencies. And so we'll have a similar format as we had for our previous hearings. We'll group testifiers in groups of three. They will do their 10-minute presentations, 8 to 10-minute presentations, and then we'll take a break and have member questions and answers, and then we'll have a second panel, approximately 1:45, 1:50 p.m., and that will be the transit-related agencies. We're going to start with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, MnDOT, and the Department of Public Safety. So our first guest today, a testifier, is Mr. Brian Ricks. He is the executive director and the CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. It's wonderful to have you, Mr. Ricks. Please welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein, and good afternoon, members. It's great to be with you. My name is Brian Ricks. I'm executive director and CEO of the Metropolitan Airports Commission. You want me to go ahead and proceed?
Yeah, please, CEO Ricks, you can proceed with your presentation.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you very much. It's great to be with you again this afternoon. I know we gave a report early on in COVID, and I'll give you a really high level view of some of the impacts that are happening. Mitch Killian is with me, who I think probably you all know as our VP of Government Affairs, and does a great job for it. Mitch, you can go to the next slide. Obviously, the impact of COVID has been very, very significant on the aviation industry. It's been the most challenging time that we've ever experienced as the MAC, and which is I'm sure no surprise. But I also want to recognize our Board of Commissioners led by Rick King, who I'm sure many of you know, that have done a phenomenal job of supporting myself, supporting our staff as we've navigated our way through this. The projections back in March were that the U.S. airport industry would lose about $23 billion this year, or between March 20th and March of 21. Some new projections are that there'll be another $17 billion in losses between April of 21 and April of 22. So we're not seeing much relief from this yet, but tremendous, tremendous impacts. Next slide, Mitch. You know, when we dropped into this early, we were actually, and I was talking to the chair a little bit about how we were concerned about the MnDOT Road project coming into the airport. We were concerned about TSA security lines, and certainly all of a sudden the bottom dropped out. Typical day of screening is 40 to 50,000 passengers during spring break, and those days actually went down to about 1,700 passengers early on, so about a 95% reduction. Our initial goals as we dropped into COVID was number one, help prevent the spread of COVID-19 at MSP and accommodate, ensure that we had a safe operating environment for our employees and those passengers that still needed to travel, and obviously focus on safety, security, and the health of everyone coming through those facilities. Next slide, Mitch. When we first came into this, our passenger levels, as I said, dropped to 95% or less than 2,000 per day. Airlines cut 105 routes, which was typically about 220 routes, daily routes out of MSP during that time. Daily arrivals and departures declined from about 1,200 per day to less than 400. And airlines took over 1.5 million seats per month out of the market. And to compare that, typically we have about 1.9 million seats in the market. So we've seen a very, very slow recovery. It's been uneven. It started progressing a little quicker early on. And then with the second and third wave of COVID, that certainly brought things back. This is a slide of our active and suspended routes. You can see in early March, we were at 223 active routes. That number dropped down to 91 active routes and 105 suspended airline routes out of MSP. That number has slowly climbed up. Today, we're at 155 active routes and about 62 suspended routes. Those suspended routes, 18 are international routes, 44 are domestic. Of the active routes, there's 134 domestic and 21 international routes currently. Next slide, Mitch. This gives you a little bit of a sense of our throughput, average weekly throughput through TSA security. And these numbers on that graph are average daily throughput for those weeks. And again, you can see early on January, actually it starts with February, but January we were up about 6%. February we were up almost 9% from 2019 levels, and then everything just dropped. And you can see the numbers of, you know, down to 1,500 passengers per day. Again, typically experiencing 40 to 50,000 passengers per day through security screening. That has ramped up and then kind of leveled off. We did see a little bit of a spike around Christmas and New Year's, and then just recently around the Martin Luther King holiday, but still 60 to 65% below what we should be experiencing at this time of year. Next slide, Mitch. It has had a dramatic effect on our concessions. Nearly half of our 135 food, retail, and service concessions remain closed. From a parking standpoint, we're typically seeing 3,000 to 5,000 vehicles park. And to put that in perspective, we have 28,000 parking locations between Terminals 1 and Terminal 2. From a revenue standpoint, our revenues are down about 47 to 48%. We typically, or we forecasted that we would be at a $406 million in revenue this year, and that is about we're off that by about $194 million. We've also lost about $51 million in passenger facility charges. The PFC, as we refer to it, is the $4.50 fee that passengers pay that comes back to the airport to support infrastructure development and helps us pay back the bonds that we issue when doing construction. We have had some federal relief. Airports got in early on the CARES Act funding, the first round of CARES Act funding. We received about $125 million of that. And then more recently, there was an additional $2 billion for airports, and we're estimating about $25 million in additional CARES Act funding. Those CARES Act are going to help us pay our debt service commitments, which are about $110 million per year in support of, again, infrastructure development. Next slide. We are really focused on the health and safety of our customers. Early on, we put together a playbook that really is guidelines for our entire MSP community to ensure the safety of our customers and the passengers. We've instituted best practices, and the goal is obviously to provide confidence in travel and so that when travel is really ready to come back, we can have a consistent and safe experience for our traveling community. Next slide, Mitch. There's six different aspects of our Travel Confidently program. Robust cleaning, which we have traditionally really done a good job of and have been an award-winning airport in that regard. Hand sanitizing, which we all know is important. Face coverings, we required face coverings early on. Social distancing, shields and barriers, and touchless parking through our parking reservation system. So those are the main aspects that we continue to promote and really focus on as we move forward. We also early on put together traveler care packages so that if a traveler shows up to the airport and does not have a mask, we can provide them one. We've got tips about flying safe, and we have sanitization in there also to, again, keep travelers as safe as possible. One of the other things that we've been focused on early on is we've participated in some of our industry accreditation processes. We just announced this week, or actually, that we are part of a GBAC STAR program. It's in partnership with the Global Biorisk Advisory Council. It recognizes airports that maintain certain standards to minimize the risk of coronavirus and other infectious agents. and also have recently acquired an accreditation through the International Council of Aviation Organizations, a health accreditation program. So we're very proud that we've been able to do that. It was a lengthy process to receive those accreditations, but we were early on and are part of, I think, about 15 to 20 airports that are now accredited in this regard. You know, I think moving forward, it's really about monitoring and adapting to changes. It's a dynamic situation, as we all know. We continue to stay in very close contact with both state and federal agencies to ensure that we're doing all we can. You may know we worked with the state to set up a testing site, which we thought was important on the airport with the state of Minnesota. We continue to look at best practices. Technology and innovation will be a big part of this as we move forward. We are really focused on a touchless and seamless passenger journey, and innovation and technology needs to play a big part in that. I think the big question is for us is really what will be the long-term impact of travel and of business travel. You know, that we're all getting used to doing business in this type of mode, and I don't think we'll know that for a while. The other thing that I continually talk about is we need consistent standards across airports, both nationally and globally, and we are working with federal and global partners to try to establish that, because it's going to be really important that no matter what airport you're departing from or arriving to or connecting through, that you know that you're going to be safe no matter what airport that is. Next slide, Mitch. So we've got a long ways to go, I think, till recovery. We are doing all we can to continue to protect this tremendous asset we have at MSP and frankly, our entire reliever airport system. You know, it's an important asset generating over, you know, $16 billion annually in economic input, 87,000 jobs. So you can rest assured that we are continuing to be at the top of our game to ensure that we do everything possible to ensure that we recover as quickly as possible. That's all I had for today, Chairman, and be happy to answer questions either now or if you want to do that later on as well.
Yeah. Thank you so much, CEO Ricks. And yes, we'll hear from Commissioner Anderson Kelleher and Colonel Langer, and then we'll get to questions. And Rep. Zemkoznik, I did have you number one on the list, I think, and you had your hand up. And so we'll hear Rep. Zemkoznik's question after the other presenters. But before we move on from the airport, Mr. Ricks, I did want to thank you for, I think it was right around a year ago or so, I showed up at a PAC hearing that you had at your chambers about the $15 wage. And I appreciate the work that you and the commissioners did on that. And, you know, obviously we've had some issues with layoffs, et cetera, at the airport with not only just the workers there, but also airline employees, et cetera. So we hope that will recover as well, but I appreciate that work. And I just wanted to say that publicly.
Thank you.
Our next speaker is the commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Transportation, our friend and no stranger to this committee and the state legislature, Commissioner Anderson Kelleher. Thank you very much for your presence today. Please state your name for the record.
Well, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'm Margaret Anderson Kelleher. I am the Commissioner of Transportation for the state of Minnesota, and we are pleased to be with you to give you this update on COVID impacts and the Department of Transportation. I know that Mr. Radin is going to be running the slides, our Director of Government Affairs. I also am presenting as well, so we're going to work in tandem here on this. So first of all, and I am just going to make sure that I set my timer so I keep myself on track, which I think is important here. First of all, you will see that this is one of our recent message boards. This was during the month of December, And for those of you who cannot see the message board right now, it actually says Zoom with your family, not with your car. And I suspect that Colonel Langer is going to talk about this COVID impact as well. And that is an impact that has been the increase of speeding. Well, dealing with the next slide, which is the decrease in traffic volumes. And the traffic volume story, a little like the airport story, you can see this just really, we went way down into the valley in early April. We had basically a 70% less than the historic average on Easter Sunday. That's the black dot you see right around the 401 mark here. We also had a significant snow event that weekend, which contributed to such a sharp decline. It wasn't uncommon during this period, Mr. Chairman, to see volumes down 40 to 50% from historical averages in March and April. You can also see that we have had a rebound in traffic. For much of the summer, there still remained about 5 to 10% less travel than previous years. But more recently, we have seen real ups and downs, just depending on the day of the week. And of course, this will play into our revenue story in a bit, but I wanted to show you overall what this has looked like. And this is statewide. A lot of our traffic sensors and cameras are in the Twin Cities, but we do have others around the state. And so we are able to get that statewide perspective. Eric, let's go to the next slide. One of the most important, if not the most important thing for us, along with providing excellent service, has been prioritizing the safety of our workforce. MnDOT has more than 5,000 employees, and the majority of our workforce has continued reporting to their work locations. Think about your snowplow drivers, your maintenance operators, essential jobs that MnDOT does. We have really worked very, very hard to make sure that people, no matter where they're working, are safe, and especially at their work site. So that has included things like instituting masking requirements that have been in accordance with the executive order, staggering shift times, limiting sharing of vehicles, which before the pandemic was a fairly regular exercise at MnDOT, floor markings and other protocols to keep social distancing. When practical, we would assign staff to particular pieces of equipment, sanitizing. We have a really good sanitizing the plows and vehicles between all shifts. And then 30% of our workforce, if possible, works remotely right now. I'm going to go to the next slide, have Eric go to the next slide, which is the 2020 construction season. Unlike other states that had to either delay or cancel projects, and some of that was COVID related directly because of workforce issues, a lot of it was budget related, what was happening. And so I want to share with you that we completed more than 200 road and bridge projects last year. An important one that Mr. Ricks just talked about was around the airport project, Highway 5, totally completed within this construction season. It was always the plan, but we were able to start a couple weeks early and get going, and it went very, very smoothly. You can also see projects like the Highway 63 bridge in Red Wing being completed, Highway 23, Cottonwood and Granite Falls, 210 in Fergus Falls. And then, of course, importantly, work continues on the very large I-35W to 94 project. We still anticipate a fall 2021 completion. We also have a few projects that we're starting up this year, the Twin Ports Interchange in Duluth, as well as the I-94 Maple Grove to Clearwater project. I want to mention that work zone safety is an important part of keeping our workforce safe and our contractors safe. So in 2020, work zone crashes went down by 16% compared to a similar baseline in 2017 and 2019. However, fatal crashes in work zones went up by 2%, which is pretty concerning when you think about that crash number coming down. So we are keeping an eye on this. This is something that we work on regularly with the Department of Public Safety and Colonel Langer to try to prevent these sorts of crashes from happening, you know, anywhere. But in the work zone, it's particularly important since our staff and contractors are often on foot or in vehicles that don't have a seatbelt, safety protection, those sorts of things. I am going to have Eric move to the next slide, which is our revenue impact. And because of largely because of COVID, our overall reduction from our February 2020 forecast was down at one point $244 million is what we were predicting. We've had some slight recovery in these numbers compared to our original prediction, and you're seeing the numbers here on the screen that are the actuals at this point for motor vehicle, vehicle registration, and sales tax. We're a little better than where we thought we were going to be after we made that May progress report, I guess I would call it. It was more of a prediction than a forecast at that point, where gas tax has recovered about $34 million from that point. Again, $34 million in tab fees and $83 million in MVEST. This is important. We're still down overall. And I think that's one of the things that I want to share with you. And you certainly can go and see our financial snapshot. The link is here on the screen at MnDOT.gov/funding/forward-funding. And we also are getting a little bit of the second COVID relief bill coming in. I want to share with you that appears to be about $160 million directly to the DOT. Of that, $90 million will go to local governments, the Met Council, and our local government partners, leaving us about $70 million to put into the Department of Transportation and back into, actually has a lot of flexibility, but we anticipate that many of those dollars will go directly into the program area. Eric can go to the next slide, snow and ice planning. One of the other big pieces of being able to make it through a COVID environment is keeping people safe, both on the roadways and our workforce. And so we began planning, our team began planning back in May already for snow and ice contingency. We have a goal. Our goal is no truck station shut down due to COVID-19. And to do this, that means making sure that our fleet of 850 plows and 1,800 trained snowplow drivers can keep working. We know that businesses, residents, vaccine supply all depend on clear roads right now and emergency services. So we're taking this responsibility super seriously. We have quite an extensive plan. The prevention strategies include distributing work to adjacent stations if needed, utilizing volunteer employees from MnDOT with commercial driver's license. You're all safe. I am not one of those people. And partnerships and collaboration with local agencies. You know, when our snow fighters are out there battling the snow, they want to be doing that. We want to keep them working and we want to keep them safe and keep the public safe all at the same time. I want to focus next, and Eric, I'm going to ask you to go to the next slide, on COVID-19 innovations. So MnDOT moved very quickly to be able to make some dramatic changes in response to COVID-19. We are actually tracking our innovations at MnDOT. We are measuring what we're doing. We're keeping track of them. We're looking at how employees feel about using these innovative processes or pieces of equipment as we go along. We had over 90 changes. So far in our measurement and our surveying of employees, 80% of these innovations have been successful. We're looking at ways we can permanently put them into our delivery system. And I want to touch on one thing in particular. You could see a few of these innovations right here on the screen. A really important was actually public engagement. This was something that we were quite worried about at MnDOT. How were we going to provide engagement for the public on upcoming projects or projects in process? And I am happy to say that virtual engagement actually works in this environment. We recently had 1,000 people attend a virtual open house for the Highway 67 Granite Falls to Echo project. That is amazing. I don't know that we could get that many people to come to an in-person open house. So we believe that this is providing lessons for us. In just one cross-agency meeting, staff estimated that 1,200 pages of paper were saved and 1,500 miles of travel. We're going to go very quickly here to our post-pandemic slide. You know, MnDOT right now currently has 1,600 teleworkers per day out of 5,000 employees. We know that employees actually are have real, those employees who are able to work from home are asking us, how can I at least work part of the time from home? So we are working on this process, working through with our employees how we might do that, what it might mean for the state of Minnesota, and how we can successfully have also an equitable and fair workplace as people are reporting to their work site as well as working from home. I'm going to have Eric go to the next slide. We have a lot of information for you always on our MnDOT.gov webpage. And I also want to mention that through tomorrow, you can submit your idea for Name a Snowplow. This really came out of the public asking us to do this program. Scotland started to do it, and it's a way we can engage in the public that is safe and interesting and helps people have awareness of our snow fighters out on the road and take some pride in the work that they are doing and protect them and have a good response to them. Final slide here is the 35W Bridge lit purple on November 19th when landmarks across the state were lit to really remember those who died of COVID-19. So, Mr. Chairman, I am going to stop there, and I know that you are going to have DPS next, and then we're going to take questions. Thank you.
Exactly. You suggested exactly what I was going to say, and we appreciate your excellent presentation. And members, I mean, maybe we could have a transportation committee joint nomination for the plow naming. So I will send your suggestions to Mr. Howe, and maybe we'll pass those on to you, Commissioner. Thank you very much. And as Commissioner Anderson Geller said, we'll have questions after Colonel Langer. Colonel Langer, welcome to the committee. Thank you very much for coming. And we will hear from Colonel Langer. And then approximately 1:45, we'll have some time for a few questions. And then we'll move on to our next presenters. Colonel Langer, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. It's my first time before the committee, so it's good to be back. I wish we were in person, but this will have to do for a while. Just in a real short period of time, want to talk a little bit about what is going on. I should back up and say that I'm Matt Langer. I have the honor and privilege of serving as the Colonel of the Minnesota State Patrol. I think I know almost everyone on the committee, but didn't want to miss that point of introduction. And after me will be Mike Hansen, the Director of the Office of Traffic Safety, and we'll be concise and tight here with the 10-minute time frame. My task is to kind of probably tell you what you already know and what you've witnessed on our roads related to COVID-19. But if Jordan wants to jump into the very first slide, I can talk about it. As Commissioner Anderson Kelleher noted, there's been a significant reduction in the vehicle miles traveled. Congestion has changed a lot since COVID-19. We have a variety of challenges on our roads, as this committee knows full well. I talk about the fatal four that are the biggest challenges for us, that being distraction, impairment, seat belts, and then speed. We've had our hands full with all of them for quite some time to varying degrees, but right now speed happens to be the thing that we're challenged by the most, and speed also happens to be the only one of those four that makes everything else worse. And so you'll see that that's reflected in the fatal crash data, regrettably, as well, if we want to go into the next slide. This slide articulates quite well the number of citations issued by state troopers for those driving in excess of 100 miles per hour. You can see in calendar year 2019, the blue graph represents the number of citations issued. The green dots represent what our troopers have experienced over the calendar year in 2020. And if I put this into context just a little bit, first of all, the State Patrol makes about 200,000 traffic stops each year for speeding and takes the appropriate enforcement action each one of those times during those traffic stops. If I tell just a few stories here that I think set the context really well, on January 10th, on Highway 10 in Fergus Falls, a group of our troopers got together while they were working. They joined up with two stations and they did some speed saturation work. In that short period of time, they encountered a lot of people speeding. But in particular, Trooper Tony Schmidt stopped a vehicle for traveling 102 miles an hour in the 70 zone. Trooper John Lamsky stopped a vehicle for traveling 108 miles an hour in a 70 zone. Lieutenant Mike Engham clocked a vehicle at 115 miles an hour in a 70 zone. That ended up with that driver, after a very brief pursuit, being arrested for being also impaired and having outstanding warrants for impaired driving. And then last but not least, the notable instance with that work that was done that day was Trooper Evan Mounts. Cited a driver, stopped a driver 100 miles an hour, 7 zone. That resulted in a traffic stop. Actually arrested for first degree homicide. The U.S. Marshals had a warrant out for his arrest for a homicide in Toronto in 2019, and the vehicle contained 67 handguns and numerous other issues. So from a traffic safety perspective, there's no question that speeding is a huge challenge. The people that are tending to speed in excess of 100 miles an hour are risk takers, and they're taking advantage of the reduced congestion on the roadways all across Minnesota. And sadly, that has resulted in crash numbers going in the wrong direction. Jordan, if you would. I'm going to turn this over at this point to Director Mike Hansen from the Office of Traffic Safety to just walk through a little bit of the data related to speed and the impact to crashes on our roads. Director Hansen. And if he's not coming, I can keep going in the interest of time. You can see, there he is, Director Hansen.
No, I'm sorry about that. I thought I clicked on the right button. Thank you, Colonel and Chair Hornstein, committee members. My name is Mike Hansen. I currently have the pleasure of serving as the director for the DPS Office of Traffic Safety. As the Colonel laid out very clearly, speed has been the biggest problem that we've seen on Minnesota roads during 2020. What we're seeing illustrated here in this particular graph is the speed-related fatal and serious injury crashes for 2015 through 2019. Then the light blue bar would be the average, and then we can see what happened in 2020. Approximately 40 additional speed-related fatal crashes took place in 2020, which accounts for almost a 9% increase in our total fatalities. Just to refresh everybody's memory, 2019, we saw 364 Minnesotans lose their lives in traffic crashes on Minnesota roads. In 2020, the preliminary numbers are 398. So again, a 9% increase in the number of fatalities that we're experiencing. Next slide, please, Jordan. One question that I frequently get asked is, where are these crashes happening? Well, quite honestly, it's everywhere. The graph before you shows the particular road systems that are experiencing the speed attributed fatalities and serious injury crashes. County road systems, 32%, state trunk highways, US trunk highways, 29%, 26%, surprisingly, are occurring on our city streets. And then 13%, which is something that is growing a little bit, that tends to be most of our township roads in greater Minnesota. One other point to take with this is, you know, where do fatal crashes happen, in metro areas or in greater Minnesota? Well, historically, and this data is kind of backed up by this slide, about 70% of fatalities occur outside of our metropolitan areas in greater Minnesota. Next slide, please, Jordan. So I'm going to turn this over to the Colonel to introduce what are we doing about this. We know we have a problem. We can't just sit there and watch these numbers go up without having a response to it. So, Colonel, do you want to introduce the plan that we've been working on?
Yep. Thanks, Director. So I started by talking about what we're doing and articulating some of the problems. Director Hansen talked about some of the data. It's really an opportunity to get in front of this committee and already talk to you about what we are doing on this issue. So throughout the course of 2020, discussions ensued toward the end of the year. A variety of us got together a few times to talk about some work zone speed enforcement, and that resulted in a desire to do something right now. And so starting January 1st, the Minnesota State Patrol kicked off a speed and aggressive driving safety and enforcement project. It's really aimed at trying to, you know, in the politest sense, take our roads back, meaning to try to get speeds back under control to a point that it makes it safer for everyone who's on the road. We started that on January 1st. That includes troopers as part of their regular duty, working together with their other partners to focus on speed enforcement. The goal, of course, is to prevent those fatal and serious injury crashes through enforcement and education. That started at the first of the year with the State Patrol. We have the task of being the primary traffic safety oriented law enforcement organization in Minnesota. It's our mission under 299D. It's what's required of us and why one of the foundational reasons why we exist. We are also working really closely with the Office of Traffic Safety as they are working with their grant programs to secure the funds that will roll together and they ultimately will create a sustained program throughout the entire calendar year, including law enforcement agencies from all across Minnesota, both county, city, and state. You'll see soon a media engagement plan and a public rollout and messaging related to this program, consistent with what we've always done at the State Patrol and the Department of Public Safety, that we like to tell people what we're doing. We're interested in changing their behavior far more than we are issuing citations, but of course, education and enforcement together work really well and much, much better than either one of them apart. That, Mr. Chair, I think lays out the path forward collaboratively at the Department of Public Safety with others, and we stand for any questions that you or members of the committee might have.
Thank you very much, Colonel Langer. And members, we have a few minutes for questions, not a lot. We can probably take two or three. And as I mentioned before, if you have questions that we can't get to you, please pass those on to Mr. Howe, and he'll pass those on to our guests, and they can respond in writing briefly, and then we can at least make sure that your question is answered. So I'm going to take... I know, Representative Kosnick, you had your hand up before, then it was down. If you want to ask a question, feel free. If you want to wait till later, that's fine as well. But I do have Representative Petersburg. But Representative Kosnick, I'm going to give you first dibs because you had your hand up at one time.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. And just be real quick, if to the Mr. Ricks from the airport could talk about the restaurant business in that, it's not really the airport's main focus, but it's important to a lot of our districts. If you could talk about the restaurants that were open, have there been any COVID outbreaks or with those? And I know that you'd mentioned the airport's council had a cleaning award that you guys had won. Maybe those are some practices that we could transfer into our other establishments to continue to allow our hospitality businesses to thrive better. Maybe there's some practices we could learn. So if you had any COVID outbreaks and what's the experience been of the restaurants, people obviously needing accommodations when they're traveling. I presume that's why they were open, but certainly I don't think COVID recognizes the difference whether a restaurant's in an airport or in downtown anywhere in Minnesota. If you could comment on that, thank you.
CEO Ricks, thank you, Representative Kosnick. CEO Ricks.
Chair Hornstein and Representative Kosnick, thank you for that question. I mean, we've taken that obviously very seriously and worked very closely with our many concessionaires out here at the facilities. As I mentioned, there's about 54% that are currently open, so it's impossible, obviously, to have all of them open because they just can't be successful with the limited traffic volume. And we were actually down, I mean, when it first hit, down about 20 to 25% were open. But we have taken a number of steps. Obviously, the steps I outlined regarding social distancing, no more than two patrons together at a bar in one location. We've added additional seating out into areas that they traditionally did not lease to help with that social distancing aspect as well. So we have taken all of those things into account and ensured that people are as safe as they can be. And if we're identifying restaurants or concessionaires that we do not feel are acting appropriately, we will use our police department and take effective action. So it's been a really strong collaboration. Communication has been the key to that. We have not had any outbreaks at the restaurants that I'm aware of. And so I think it's worked very well. We did get some questions early on about why are airport restaurants still open and others not. I think we've done a good job of answering that. The challenge is there isn't much food at all on aircraft anymore. And as you know, we're a big connecting airport, and we really need to be able to provide some services to those, the traveling public. The other things we've instituted is grab and go. We've instituted programs that people can order and have food delivered at the gate areas as well. So we've really advanced technology in those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Ricks. I'm going to take a question from Representative Petersburg and Representative Mason, then we're going to have to move on from there. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so this is for public safety slides. In which we talked about the slide on speeding and fatalities. And it looks to me like there was quite a big jump from 15 to 16, where 15 was quite low. Do we know why that occurs? Because if we take that outlier off of the average, our average over the last 4 years is a little bit higher. But what made the difference between 15 and 16? Does anybody know?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Petersburg, if we look at the graph, that's fatal and serious injury crashes. And in 2016, a definition change in how serious injury crashes were classified in the state reporting system resulted in not just in speed related, but an overall increase in the number of reported serious injury crashes. And so slowly that number has been coming back into more of an equilibrium. So that's why you see that large difference from 15 to 16. It was a definition change that came about as a part of some of the federal regulation and then the update to the state crash reporting system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. That kind of answers that question, but it also then answers the questions, if we're not comparing the same, should it have been eliminated from the average? And no need to answer. It's just my question. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Well, thank you. And maybe, Mr. Hansen, you can communicate with Representative Petersburg on that one offline. But appreciate your answer and your question, Representative Petersburg. Our last question for this segment is from Representative Mason, and then we'll hear from Mr. Zelli right after that. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is regarding people that are going 90, 100 miles an hour. I got to believe most of us know that's not an acceptable speed. So what kind of education are you planning on addressing that? I'm just really curious. I mean, that's a big, big task.
So that's either for Mr. Hansen or Colonel Langer.
Yeah, I can.
Langer, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Mason. Believe it or not, people sometimes will say they didn't know that they were going that fast. We don't usually believe that when you're traveling 100 miles an hour or more. That is almost always certainly an intentional act that endangers both the driver and others on the road. And so, to be quite curt, the public message is, if you're going to do that, we're looking for you and you're going to get a ticket for it. That's kind of the message that we're intending to send there. One of the things I've heard the most from citizens about the sort of COVID-19 era on our roads is that Minnesotans are tired of the aggressive driving and the speeds, and they're thankful that we're out there doing something about it. So the educational message will be pretty simple, that we're out there and we're looking for you. And if we find you, you can expect to get a ticket for driving in excess of the speed limit, but in particular, those ridiculously excessive speeds that put us all at risk.
Thank you, Colonel Langer. Thank you, Colonel Langer, for that. And just one other note before we move on. And thank you also to all those all of our speakers today. Very, very helpful and informative. On this note of speeding, you know, in addition to traffic safety, we are going to be looking at MnDOT's. MnDOT has a report on pedestrian issues and pedestrian safety. I know that when we went around the first day, a number of members talked about that. You know, obviously speeding is a factor in deaths among pedestrians. And, you know, obviously there's road design and infrastructure issues related to pedestrian safety as well. But we're going to be taking a good look at that later on, and looking forward to MnDOT's report on that. So again, thank you again to our guests and our collaborators on transportation in state government and regional government when we look at the MAC, although the MAC is a statewide agency as well. We look forward to, you know, our continued work together. And we'll be hearing from all of these agencies at different points later on in our session. But today was really just limited to COVID response. So with that, members, we are going to pivot now to transit. Thank you to our speakers. We'll hear first from Charlie Zelli, the chairman of the Metropolitan Council. Mr. Zelli, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. And yes, I am Charlie Zelli, Chair of the Metropolitan Council. And I am entrusted to by my staff to actually share my screen. So if everybody can see that, my commercial driver's license has lapsed, but I am seeing if I can operate this. It's great to hear from my colleagues in modes of transportation. I'm going to talk about Metropolitan Transit. As maybe everybody knows, Met Council has really two functions, transportation planning and contracting of various transportation elements like Metro Mobility, Transit Link, some additional involvement with providing funds for other contracted routes like the suburban routes. But also we operate Met Transit, which is commuter rail, light rail, and bus. As the chair pointed out, I'm really going to talk briefly about COVID impacts. You know, and it really is like the MAC and MnDOT and DPS, we've really seen a loss in revenue. Really, that loss of revenue comes from a loss of ridership. And I'm going to get into some specifics. And you're going to get a report in a few weeks about where how we've spent CARES funding, CARES Act funding, both the first round and now a second round coming. That has really kept operations going at Met Transit and as we allocate funds to other providers. One of the elements that we spend the funding on is actually increasing the safety and the protocols, which I'll get into in a minute. And just to let everybody know, you know, because it's a great concern of ours, it's brought a lot of the safety issues that we care about into clear focus. We are leaning into the idea that safety is our number one priority. And we look to come back to the legislature with some of the work we've discussed in the past. As we lean into safety, having more people on our trains and on our our arterial bus rapid transit to help monitor and help increase an element of or an atmosphere of safety is one I think that will be a great benefit. Of course, as part of that, we really appreciate the work of Representative Kosnick and Representative Elkins, you know, helping kind of promote this idea of allowing others to give administrative citations rather than having our valuable Metro Transit police being distracted with doing fare enforcement by having these misdemeanor charges with fares as much as $180. Now, if we can get actually more eyes and ears and cameras, we will help to promote safety. So even although our safety numbers are down because our ridership is down, it continues to be increasingly our number one issue. Speaking of ridership, it's been quite a fall. You can see over the past 9 months, we have reductions in all categories, but you'll see the express buses and certainly North Star is similar. We have ridership as low as a drop as much as 95%. Rail is down. The local bus is actually only down about 50%. And I will show you this graph. It shows it even better, the different kind of elements of transit. Clearly, those express buses, which are going to the downtowns, this is a population that is more likely to be able to telecommute. But the more local kind of activity, local bus, and particularly kind of our star, which is this bus rapid transit. This is the A line and the C line. Frequent service has the feel of light rail and yet is providing a service through a lot of local destinations. They're really only down 50%. And that's down a lot, but it shows that we're actually carrying between 80,000 and 90,000 rides on a weekday. And this is essential workers who are providing all the kind of the, frankly, whether it's grocery store, medical workers, factory workers, these are the folks who have to show up physically to work. We are not actually promoting our service. We are maintaining the social distancing and the amount of operations to keep safety in place. But it shows that the real important work that transit is doing, even during this kind of low ridership period. It's only low in a relative sense. You'll see where some of our biggest ridership is happening during this period of time. And we put this map to show the areas of concentrated poverty to show that these are folks who are most dependent on transit and who have been disproportionately affected by this economy. And yet we are able to provide access at a time when their ability to get to work is so important. Talking about our Metro Mobility and our Transit Link ridership, we were able to pivot and provide both food services, both from food shelves and actually grocery deliveries to those that had a hard time accessing food, but also started opening up trips for essential healthcare workers. This is single occupancy, Metro Mobility trips, and that has really increased to as much as 8,000 trips a day. We've been able to provide support for healthcare workers. And we're really proud of that service because we had the capacity, we had the funds, and it was really, I think, at the time and continues to be an important way for those essential healthcare workers to get to their jobs when they are under such stress and where there is such a shortage. And I think we've gotten a lot of favorable comments, both from the workers themselves, but also from hospital administrators and clinicians who really depend upon that staff. This kind of shows you a little bit how we are deploying the operating miles. We have initially, we had down to maybe 60% of the operating miles of our bus system and our our LRT system. But we have brought it back to about 80% now since about September. And that doesn't mean that every route is cut back 20%. We have redeployed the miles in order to maintain load factors, which are safe. We require masks. We have protocols in place so that we don't have overcrowded buses. And you'll see on the far right under BRT, we actually are operating 125% from the kind of schedules we were operating pre-pandemic. So it actually, we've actually redeployed our both our buses and our articulated buses to ensure that the most heavily traveled and the what I would call the essential routes, routes like Route 5, where we actually can carry people safely. I talked about some of what we're doing with Metro Mobility and healthcare workers. You can see again how the worker trips for healthcare has really increased and continues to increase to this day. I want to talk a little bit about what we're doing in terms of cleanliness. No different than the MAC when we're looking at ways to ensure that we're following best practices for our industry. You'll see that the rear entrance was what we did through the summer until such time as we could have protective driver shields so that they didn't come in contact with customers. Kind of the care and health of our customers and the care and health of our employees are both equally important. When we think about testing, this is something else we've rolled out. So we have regular on-site temperature testing and also frequent COVID testing for all Metro Transit employees. We look ahead, we think about how we might be able to increase service as the economy starts to return. We know that the vaccination of transit workers is anticipated. I think it's a 1B as opposed to 1A, but we are certainly in place to provide those vaccinations to ensure that our frontline workers, who in a sense kind of embody the essential workers, such as you've seen this operator, they're the ones, they're the real heroes of our operation, and that we can't get vaccinations soon enough to get back to the protocols that we hope and expect. So thank you so much, and I will look forward to taking questions later in the moment we have here.
Thank you so much, Mr. Zelli. That was a very helpful and informative presentation. Next up, we have Tiffany Collins. Ms. Collins is the is representing the Minnesota Public Transit Association, and she is the transit director for Central Community Transit. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Collins, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Tiffany Collins. I'm with the Central Community Transit again. We serve Cando High, Meeker, and Renville counties. And again, I'll be representing the Minnesota Public Transit Association today. So just some brief words about how the COVID pandemic has affected us in greater Minnesota. I think it's been really important that the transit systems have been involved in community response teams that have formed across the counties and try to look at some of the issues that have risen with transportation needs and things like that, and things that we can help with across the greater Minnesota. And so some of the initial things that we became involved in is student meal transportation and distribution. As when the shutdowns began, we noticed that many of the schools had not planned for transportation or much less having food available for students. So Operation Gap Week was a big thing for us to just launch ourselves into what are we here to help with. And so we were able to help with over 8,000 student meals overnight, basically, for a good week there, which has also led us into providing Meals on Wheels senior dining and food shelf pickups that we never dreamed of doing on transit vehicles as well. So our goal, obviously, through the pandemic was definitely to have our drivers be able to do their job safely. And so it was definitely challenging and a big deal for us to try to locate PPE, such as gloves, masks, gowns, face shields, those types of things. In Greater Minnesota, most of our bus drivers are getting out to assist passengers that are using wheelchairs and walkers and things like that. So we do need to get up close and personal with some of our passengers. So some of that was definitely needed. And so looking for cleaners and things like that, and also installing the plexiglass barriers that you saw earlier in some of the larger vehicles. But we definitely were playing a part in locating and designing plexiglass barriers for our drivers so that both of our drivers and passengers could remain safe as well. We also run volunteer driver programs, especially in the greater Minnesota area. That's very important to help with the transportation that needs to continue for things like dialysis treatments, cancer treatments. And so we definitely wanted to make sure that we could keep our volunteer drivers safe during the pandemic as well. So we also had to secure some of those items, such as PPE and disinfectant procedures and protocols for the volunteer programs as well. So as we all know, through the pandemic, the majority of our ridership did definitely go down. And you saw several graphs so far in the presentation today. Our graphs look very similar to some of the ones that you've seen as well. The lowest that we had seen in Greater Minnesota is a reduction of 90% of our ridership, only operating about 10% during the lowest time in April. We have since then climbed back up to close to 50 to 60% across the state, back and forth. And we are also seeing a lot of up and down over the last month or so, just due to things kind of trying to come back and things like that. But definitely seeing some of the same trends that the larger systems, even the traffic patterns and things like that seem to be very similar in Greater Minnesota as well. The volunteer driver program did worry quite a bit about trying to do transportation, especially for our senior populations. We had turned to helping with a program called Telephone Reassurance, which allowed us to reach out to passengers and reassure that their needs are being met, that food was being delivered, services, prescriptions, those types of things. And so we could reach out to those folks and try to connect them with services. So telephone reassurance was definitely something that we are doing at this point and are doing across the state. Also, there's been some conversation lines for seniors that have popped up that CCT has helped with, just trying to be involved in, trying to be as creative as possible with some of our staff needing to find work for them. And so we were able to help with a conversation line one day a week that we committed. And also our volunteers have been involved in that. Overall, the Greater Minnesota transit systems have been definitely impacted differently. Many of the transit systems that have remained open and provided service at whatever level that there has been definitely have seen different things. Obviously, the ridership, less medical trips, the elderly day centers, and the disabled adult work centers have closed and reopened, and that deeply impacted our transportation needs, preschool and Head Start closings as they have closed and reopened and closed again. And so some of those things would definitely impact our ridership out here. And also just concerns by drivers, just making sure that they can do their jobs safely. And so that they're not going to be caused illness or safety concerns that way, and reduce service hours and things like that. So there are definitely some counties that have had to completely shut down, such as Cass County. All senior and veteran services have been reduced, and there is no bus and taxi services since last March. Also, Faith in Action, they are only using volunteers at this point, and that is the only means of transportation to be able to get their medical appointments and groceries for that. So definitely some concerns across the state for that. Moving forward, transit systems expect to try to rebuild those services that we had lost during the pandemic. The public is starting to see some of the community changes, but we continue to be available for food delivery and supply delivery. And we are also now seeing some transportation that we are providing to get to the vaccine clinics that are starting to come up as well. Some things that we're also seeing as far as changes as things do come back is social distancing on the vehicles is taking possibly some additional buses and drivers to be able to accommodate that. So rather than filling our vehicles to capacity and transfer those folks, we are definitely seeing that the need has changed there. And so we are adapting to those things and trying to be able to accommodate those as well. I would like to share a brief video.
Okay, Ms. Collins, I hope it is brief because we have one more speaker and some Q&A. How long is the video?
It's a 2-minute video.
Okay, we'll end with your video and then we'll move on to Mr. Winder.
Sounds great.
Public transit systems all over the state of Minnesota continue to serve people, businesses, and communities, even in the midst of a serious pandemic, operating all the necessary safety protocols. Bus systems have ensured that essential workers get to their jobs, residents get to critical medical services, and food gets to people who need to stay home. From cleaning and sanitizing buses and facilities to installing hand sanitizer dispensers and barriers to keep people safe, and closing off some seats to ensure proper social distancing and the safety of bus drivers and passengers, transit has kept Minnesotans moving this year. Systems went out of their way to help communities by delivering meals, prescriptions, and other necessities during one of the most trying times the country has faced in years. From big systems such as Southwest Transit assisting food shelves, to Smart Transit of Owatonna delivering 62,000 meals, all the way to Faribault Martin County Transit delivering essentials to local homes, bus systems allowed older people and those with underlying conditions to remain safe. Frontline transit workers have remained on the job, transporting essential workers and providing families with the food and health care they need amid the pandemic. Going forward, people who can't drive will need help getting to vaccination sites. Bus systems have demonstrated that they are invaluable community resources, providing access, mobility, and independence while keeping people safe. The state needs to ensure that these systems remain strong well into the future.
Thank you very much, Ms. Collins, for your presentation. Appreciate it, and we'll have questions following Mr. Winder's presentation. Our last presenter for today is Luther Winder, and he has been before our committee many times as well. He is the Chief Executive Officer of Minnesota, the Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Winder. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, everyone. Luther Winder, Chief Executive Officer for Minnesota Valley Transit Authority. Going to share my screen and do a brief presentation. So just want to take a moment to talk about some of the things from a Suburban Transit Association we've done related to COVID safety, as well as what some of the CARES funding. Overall, the region received in the first round of CARES funding, $226 million, of which suburban providers received $12 million from that allocation. We don't yet know what our allocation will be with this new round of CARES funding, where we're continuing to work with the council to determine that for that funding in the near future. What we did with the first round is we really focused on safety, as well as putting things in place that, to maintain safety for our operators, as well as for our customers. We did supersede the CDC recommendations and really led the region as far as changing our cabin air filters daily, as well as we disinfected our buses after each trip, some daily. One thing Plymouth did, one of the first in the nation to do, they actually installed a specialized air purifying technology on their buses. It's kind of like a Bluetooth speaker. It looks like a Bluetooth speaker, and it really deals with getting some of those potentially harmful air pathogens out of the air. They're testing that now, and like I said, they're the first nation to provide that technology. We did temperature checks on our operators. We're continuing to add and do additional disinfecting of our facilities that we're utilizing. One thing that Minnesota Valley did is we installed UV light technology in front of our HVAC systems and our bus garages, as well as some of our stations, in order to add another layer of filtration and disinfectant for our air quality in those facilities. We've installed operator barricades, plexiglass barricades, as all transit have talked about prior, on our buses, as well as we continue to implement and institute social distancing on our stations, as well as our buses. It's important to note that social distancing, though, adds a layer of obviously public safety, it also does increase operating costs or maintain operating costs, because you are still providing less customers, but you still need more buses to provide that adequate service. As well as to implementing, as well as following the mask mandate, as well as superseding that, providing masks to customers that may not have masks when traveling. Just a quick ridership overview. So during the pandemic, across the board, we've all seen a decrease in, obviously, ridership. It's important to note, even from Chair Zelli's presentation, as well as we see, the suburban local service continues to be extremely strong pre-pandemic. It's actually the number two category overall outside of BRT as far as ridership is concerned by percentage. What we've seen in our STA service area, we wanted to make sure everyone understands that prior to the pandemic, and this has only been exacerbated, 31% of our households in our communities only had 0 to 1 vehicle. So we have almost really exclusive and an increasing transit-dependent population, as well as about 7% of our population pre-pandemic also was 150% of the poverty threshold. What we've seen was an exasperation in need, and we'll talk about that in my next slide, and how we continue to serve those customers who had increasing needs during this particular, and right-size that with the reduction in our express services we're providing. Overall, one of the highest ridership routes, and I think this actually relates to a really good article in the Star Tribune yesterday, talking about how some individuals, whether it be African-American or Hispanic, only 20% of them are able to work from home. I know I kind of frequent and spend a lot of time with those individuals, family, friends, et cetera, that our Route 495, which was originally funded by the legislature, continues to have 74% of pre-COVID ridership. That route primarily deals with the manufacturing hub in our Shakopee area, as well as it goes to Mystic Lake Casino and our Prior Lake. Those for workers as well as for customers. We continue to see really strong ridership, because you can't work from home if you work at an Amazon fulfillment center, and you can't work from home if you're doing one of the facilities or maintenance staff providing services at Mystic Lake or some of the manufacturing hubs. As I said before, what we've tried to do is when we've seen the reduction, dramatic reduction of express ridership, redirect those resources to the needs of our local as well as our micro transit services. Talk about some of the innovative things that we've done during the pandemic with those particular services. One being, and I'll just highlight a few of the providers and pull some of the innovations out. Southwest Prime, it's important to note that 70% of their riders currently are a low-income or transit dependent. They've done some interagency collaboration with the Minnesota Valley, which they expanded their Prime to the employment centers in Shakopee, one of those being Amazon. They've done some mobile health clinics, and they've also done assistance with school transportation. Maple Grove, they've expanded their service to food shelf locations, two of them that were outside of the city limits, at no charge to customers, as well as they're doing a similar with Metro Transit, others doing grocery delivery to Maple Grove from Maple Grove stores to seniors in their service area at no charge. Minnesota Valley right now is currently researching the locations that are offering the vaccine for 65 and older, and we're looking to institute free and reduced trips to those centers to get vaccinated, as well as we've currently still on our microtransit, we provide free service for healthcare professionals to medical facilities. What we look at from a post-pandemic recovery standpoint, that understanding transit-dependent suburban communities have significant low-income and senior population due to displacement and affordable housing, which require increased lifeline and local services. We continue to look for opportunities to build back services and explore underserved markets, what we've currently been doing. Express service, as the vaccine rolls out, expectation of a steady increase in customers returning to office activities. It's important to note, even with surveys, and I talk this quite frequently, and I also sit on a national FTA panel dealing with small and medium-sized planning and the future outlook for transit, that travel patterns are cyclical. Flexible work schedule, just like the paperless offices, were really pioneered in the early 2000s, but so migration because of when it deals to work-life balance, as well as the needs for social interaction, what you've seen is this constant movement back to in-office activities. What we will continue to see is in the short term, we will definitely see a work from home component to it, but just as it was in the early 2000s, we will see a migration back for social integration as well as work-life balance back into some form of in-office work environment. And that's also the understanding where the whole WeWorks and all those other outside entities started with just adding that social component to get people out of their homes and get places when it comes to work. That will continue to happen in this particular environment as well as we recover and as the need for non-essential travel return to the transit network. Our focus right now is the preservation of the full regional network, continuing to maintain the gains we've made in our first and last mile connectivity, microtransit, and suburban services will be key to the recovery as we move forward in this post-pandemic world, which we're still in the pandemic. Hopefully we get to post-pandemic pretty soon.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Winder. Did you want to go? You've got some good context there as well. I wanted to thank you for your excellent presentation, Mr. Winder, and I think an important reminder that there are significant transit needs in suburban communities. I think sometimes people are, may not be fully aware of the extent to which we have those needs, and I appreciate your highlighting those. So we have about 7 minutes for questions. I have one already from Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What I found very interesting from these comments was how the airports, as well as our public transit, saw pretty much the same decline in ridership and growth. So I found that kind of interesting, but probably also realistic and expected. What we heard from Colonel Langer was that even with the reduction in usage, we were still finding some unsafe practices and safety concerns that they're having in regard to speeding and so forth. My question to Commissioner Zelli, Mr. Zelli, is I didn't hear anything about public safety on transit, and I'm wondering if he has any information about physical safety on buses, trains, et cetera, and whether or not they're seeing the same impact as we did with our roads and bridges.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Chair Zelli.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein and Representative Petersburg, I think that's a question that we look at very closely. You know, to be honest, we have less, you know, Category 1 incidents because the ridership is down, you know, let's just say 50, 60%. However, as maybe as I mentioned, you know, safety was an issue before the pandemic, and it just increasingly is the number one issue for us to, in order to attract the riders in the communities as the economy starts to recover, we've got to get ahead of our safety concerns. And it, and when we actually are, so by count, we're not seeing what we're seeing on the highways in terms of speeding. You know, people aren't finding vacant stations and therefore performing more crimes. We've actually now instituted, during this period of time, more live cameras in our trains, and we have cameras live on our stations. So we actually have more kind of eyes and ears, what we've described around. But we really do need more people. And in addition to our Metro Transit Police, we're planning to actually expand our police force, but we need even more, which is why we're really interested in these kind of agents working who could also be checking for tickets, who could also be the presence to create that kind of safe atmosphere. We're working with the Citizens League to do about a 6-month stakeholder engagement with business community, with communities, with employees, to really understand what it means to be safe. Because we know one person's perception of safety is different than another person's. And we're trying to get our arms around the idea that we need to be safe for everybody. But in terms of the actual raw statistics, yes, we hear anecdotes. We had a shooting a few weeks ago on a platform. We were able to, through camera identification, find out who that person was. And our Metro Transit people went to their home and arrested them. So that doesn't mean that you know, we shouldn't have those at all. This is an issue we're facing in cities around the country, as we know now, and we're not immune to that. But we're also augmenting Minneapolis police in downtowns as well as St. Paul to be a presence around the downtown environments. So we're putting more of our police to help kind of face the overall crime that we're seeing in downtowns that is unacceptable.
Thank you, Mr. Zelli. We have time for one more question if there is anyone else on the committee that has a question for any of our presenters here. I'll wait a few seconds here. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for, again, a very informative presentation. I think that, oh, we have one final question from the Vice Chair, Representative Cagle, and then I will make some concluding comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I was trying to find the button to get my hand up. One of my questions is if any of these safety measures, if there's any thought to making any of these permanent.
Okay, is that for anyone in particular, or?
I guess it would probably be more to Commissioner Zell.
Okay.
Or any of the
Mrs. Zelli?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cogle, I think that they absolutely should be permanent. I mean, we're talking about the really kind of systematic ways to deal with the issues we have today, but really it's all about the future. And kind of, I hate to say the word reclaim, but we need to reclaim the atmosphere of safety and hospitality, that transit is a mainstream activity in our lives. And this is how people get to work. This is how people get to school. This is how people get to the grocery store. And if we are having the interconnected transit system of the future where you're not dependent upon a car, that needs to be an environment that is hospitable to everybody. So it is absolutely permanent. And I think that it is not one tool, but in a number of different ways, we need to address that.
Thank you, Mr. Zion. Very quickly, if I don't know if Ms. Collins or Mr. Winder would have anything to add, this would be an opportunity. Okay. Okay, great. Well, thanks again, everybody. This was very, very helpful, very informative. And members, we our next meeting is going to be on Tuesday, January 26th, and we will be shifting now towards looking at infrastructure, transportation, road, bridge, transit, bike, ped, investments in that infrastructure as a tool for economic revitalization and recovery. That will be the topic for Tuesday. Thursday, we'll be looking at some issues around our partners in local government. And we're all at this point tentatively and likely going to hear our first bill of the year, House File 103, Representative Dabney's bill. And that's all coming on Thursday. So with that, we are adjourned and have a good weekend, everybody. Enjoy, I think, our last warm day for a little bit here. And this meeting is adjourned.